Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, 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 my friends. I am so glad to be talking with you today. Listen, I've got a treat for you. We are going to talk about a really powerful story. So today on the show, my guest is Blaine Hogan. Now, Blaine is a writer and a film and creative director who has directed celebrities from LeBron James to Carrie Underwood to Chip and Joanna Gaines and even Carlos Whitaker. He lives in Atlanta. He has a master's degree in theology and culture from the Seattle School for Theology and Psychology. Blaine, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Nurse Mama radio show.
I am so delighted, and you've got your own theme song. You've got a voice of God narrator. This is amazing.
Well, that's high praise coming from you.
Oh, my gosh. Because we met, we were just plugging away, trying to figure out how do we launch a book. And then the next thing I know, Jessica's calling me because she's got a radio show. And this is amazing. We've come a long way, friend. You have come a long way. And I mean, your work is so amazing. My wife and I are always, you know, we've got three daughters. Our oldest is 12. So, you know, you're one of the people that we look up on Instagram. We're like, oh, gosh, what is this new thing in middle school that we know nothing about? So you are an expert in our life, and I am delighted to be on the show. And just look how profesh you are. It's amazing. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much, Blaine. That is high praise coming from you. And I'm going to have to make sure that my teenagers hear all of that. You know, all of that I'm cool on Instagram
yes.
stuff. And it is true.
Please do.
We met in a writing collaborative, and you were so generous and so encouraging. And I have to tell you a funny story, Blaine, because right before I met you, you know, I'm a professor at Baylor, and everywhere I go, people don't ask me about my expertise. They ask me, do you know Chip and Joanna Gaines? And I say, from television, right? Like, I know them from TV.
Yeah.
Well, one day, right. Chip sees, I tweet about this, and I say, hey, this is my life. Every day, I go somewhere to speak about human trafficking, and people say, do you know Chip and Joanna Gaines? And Chip said, well, let's fix that. So he started messaging me through his assistant to meet him, and I thought, oh, my goodness, I might about to be get murdered. Like, is this how people get, you know, looped in on the internet?
Oh, my gosh. But right, yeah, totally catfished. Right, yeah, you should know about
yes.
it.
Yes. I know, exactly, right? Like, I'm going to, you know, live in infamy as the catfishing expert who then got catfished. But sure enough, I met Chip and Joanna at the castle they were renovating in Waco. I was trying to be all professional and represent, you know, my profession well, and I had this pantsuit on. But within 5 minutes, we were, like, climbing over the HVAC on the roof. But here's the funny thing, Blaine.
Oh,
here's where
gosh.
You come into this. I felt like this is my
okay.
big claim to fame. And here, you're directing their videos. Like, you direct the videos. So who am I?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, I did. I directed a spot for them. This was a couple of years ago when they were launching their Magnolia Network and got to spend a few days with them in Waco. Though, I mean, to climb over HVAC with Chip and Joe, I mean, that's the real deal. That's living.
Well, you are the real deal, Blaine. And what we're talking about today is the book that you wrote called Exit the Cave, Embracing a Life of Courage, Creativity, and Radical Imagination. Now, the back of this book says, if you've ever been stuck, addicted, ashamed, discontented, or lost, take courage. A richer, more imaginative, and meaningful life is waiting for you just outside the cave. Now, one of your endorsers, Laura McCowan, called this a tender but fierce story of survival, reckoning, and redemption. This is the kind of story that heals both individuals and families. I mean, wow. And I have to tell my listeners, I picked up this book, and as someone who encountered generational trauma and had troubles growing up, I could not put it down. And it took a lot of courage for you to write this. It really did. So the opening scene of this book is about you speaking at a conference, and there's nothing off the table here, Blaine. You're trapped outside your hotel room in your underwear. In your underwear, okay? And how you hit rock bottom. So let's start there. Tell us about your story.
Oh, boy. Yeah. You know, when I was writing the book, there were times where I'm like, you don't have to do this. You don't have to tell that story. You didn't include that one. Yes, it is. It's all out there in so many different ways. But in short, I had been invited to speak at a creative class conference. I was working as a creative director, and my job was to deliver the keynote speech about the creative process. And I had gotten in the evening before the conference at the hotel. And when I walked in, the lobby was filled with conference goers, which if you know you yourself, you've been to many, you can always spot the conference goers by the lanyards. And even just through check-in, the party had grown in the lobby because I was staying at the hotel that was hosting the conference. And so as I walk in, there are a couple of people who recognized me, and I said hello. And I'd gotten in late and really wanted to get up to my room as quickly as possible so I could be refreshed and ready to go. And basically, I was getting ready for bed and realized that the room service I had ordered you can't keep room service in your room overnight. I think those of you who stayed at a hotel just know that you just can't do it. It smells terribly. And so I went to go put the tray in the hallway, and I turned around, and I had locked myself out of my room. And I, as I mentioned, and as you said in the intro, I was getting ready for bed. And so I was just sitting there, standing there in my underwear, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? So I went down to the hall. By the elevator, I called down to the front desk, and this is a number of years ago where the rules have now changed. Now they'll just send security up and, you know, they'll let you in your room and you show them an ID. But at that point in time and in that particular hotel, they had a very stringent rule, which was the only way that you can be let back into your room is if you go down to the lobby and present yourself. And so I waded through the sea of party-going conference goers. More lanyards were there, and I don't know if I've ever felt more embarrassed in my life that I was, you know, I was able to get back in my room. But the next morning, you know, I was thinking about this before I went on stage. And, you know, they always tell you, and you know this as a speaker, that if you're feeling nervous, you should just always picture the audience, you know, without their clothes on. I'm positive no one has ever said that it should be the other way around. And I stepped on stage in front of all these people who a lot of them had seen me in my underwear the night before. And as I began to, you know, I opened my talk, to begin talking about the creative process, and something shifted in me. And I realized in that very moment that, you know, what I had come to do was offer some kind of tips and tricks about the creative process. But I actually felt in that moment, in some ways, because they had already seen so much of me already, that maybe a more potent thing to do would be to share my story instead. And that's really kind of how the book came about. I thought I was writing a book about the creative process, but the more that I got into the book, I realized that the best way for me to talk about the creative process, the kind of movement of, you know, in the darkness, in the depth of the cave of an idea, or not sure what the next thing to do is, that I realized that my life had actually been a work of art, and that maybe I should offer that instead. And so that really was the impetus of the book, was in that moment, and realizing maybe that's what I need to be talking about. And maybe that's more powerful than talking about the creative process, and realizing that in the end, I was kind of talking about all of it at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Well, you know, Blaine, that story always makes me laugh. And you can't see, but my producer, Stephanie, is sitting across from me. And I think this is the first time she's heard the story and she's laughing so hard. It's making me laugh again. Like, it's just making me laugh.
I am delighted but to bring a smile to your face today.
Well, you have definitely done that. And I think it is such a perfect transition and a perfect illustration of how you are very vulnerable in sharing your story. And Blaine, your story is tough. You had a tough time growing up. Why don't you give us a little glimpse into your childhood?
Yeah. So I grew up in kind of a blue-collar working suburb of Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was just kind of a lower to middle class neighborhood, and most of our parents worked jobs, more than one jobs, truck drivers and wait staff and immigrants, and it was a really colorful neighborhood. In many ways, I loved where I grew up, but also I encountered some harm during that time, particularly in my kind of, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, where I was sexually abused by some older boys in my neighborhood. My dad was an alcoholic for my entire life up until just 2017. He finally passed and kind of succumbing to his addictions. Later in life, I realized he suffered from sex addiction as well. And then my mom, who was kind of a single mom, really, to my younger brother and I, was a really severe diabetic. And so lots of memories of, you know, force feeding her orange juice when she was seizing on the floor. And, you know, kind of that all of those circumstances kind of fueled, you know, my hiding and my own addiction as I kind of moved into my adolescence and young adulthood.
And you really don't hold anything back when you're sharing that journey. You share the pain and the struggles of that. And I think that so many people will be able to identify with your story because, you know, my book is Behind Closed Doors, saying that not everything is always as it appears to be. And what you're describing mm-hmm. isn't your typical path to ministry that you took. But we just have a couple of minutes left before break. So I want you to give our listeners a little preview of Exit the Cave, because this was based on Plato's Allegory of the Cave. Tell us, give us a little setup for that.
Yeah, in brief, I was 17 years old and, you know, had already kind of been living some amount of hard life up until that point. I was sitting in the back of a humanities class, and the teacher told us this story of Plato's Allegory of the Cave. And in brief, he sets this scene where there is a tribe of people. They're in the darkness of a cave, and they're all chained to a wall, and they're looking at this giant wall in front of them. And what they're seeing are these shadows being projected onto the wall. They're seeing images of a tree, a dog, a chair. And at one point in the story, the hero stands up and realizes that the chains aren't locked and that they're free to go at any time, and begins to kind of see the artifice. Sees the shadow, sees a giant fire, sees other people passing by with all these different objects, and realizes, wait a second, nothing that I've been looking at has been real. And beyond the fire, they see a white dot, and they begin to move towards that dot of light. And as it grows, it becomes harder to see. But now they've come so far, and they can't go back. And so they make their way out of the cave. They adjust to the light, and they see the tree, and they see the chair, and they see truth and light and reality for the first time in their whole lives. And then the twist of the story, which it always gets me, is that instead of running away from the cave as far as they can, they return. They go back into the darkness, and they stand before the tribe, and they say, there is so much more. And I remember hearing that story at 17 and wondering if that was true. Is what my life has become a bunch of shadows? Is there some sort of light at the end of the tunnel? Is there some sort of truth? Is there goodness somewhere in my life ahead of me? I sort of set out on a journey to find out if that was true.
Well, Don't go away, because when we come back, we're going to talk about where Blaine was going and where he has been. I cannot wait to share that part of the journey with you. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hello, friends. We are back and we are talking to Blaine Hogan, author of Exit the Cave, Embracing a Life of Courage, Creativity, and Radical Imagination. Now, if you were listening before break, we left you on a major cliffhanger, a dramatic scene, a recap of Plato's Allegory of the Cave. And Blaine, you talk about how this book is divided into two sections based on the allegory. Where have you come from and where are you going? So we've talked a little bit about your childhood and where you've come from, but tell us now about your journey into wholeness and healing. How did that start?
Mm-hmm. Well, it started, as you kind of alluded to, at the very beginning with rock bottom. I think some of the greatest gifts that you can receive is to hit rock bottom. It is to come to the end of yourself and realize that something has to change. I think that in that way, addicts have an incredible superpower. Now, the truth is we are all addicted to something. So the good news is we're all addicts, if I can twist the phrase there. But for me, I left the story as we were talking at age 17. By that point, I had been really deeply fallen in love with the theater. And I knew that I wanted to be an actor really even long before then, probably 9 years old. And so for, the next decade is kind of what I pursued. I went to theater school, traveled around the country, everything from living history museums in Newport, Rhode Island, to horrible productions of Guys and Dolls at dinner theaters in Boca Raton, Florida, to auditioning for Broadway shows, to eventually landing in Chicago, where I got my SAG card. Everyone knows that SAG actors are on strike. But I got my card doing a show called Prison Break. I was in the first season of that. And here I was, 25 maybe, making more money than I'd ever made before, which, actually wasn't a ton of money. But it my check from 20th Century Fox had a comma in it. And I thought, oh, my God, I hit the lottery. And I was working at all the greatest theaters in Chicago where all these famous actors had kind of come from and developed. And life was pretty good. I kind of had fulfilled that goal and that dream of becoming a professional actor. Only 2% of any actors in the union, whether it's the Stage Actors Union or SAG, are working at any given moment. So it is an absolute miracle to be a working actor. And here I was doing it. Also, at the same time, I began experiencing debilitating panic attacks that were taking me to the emergency room. And I couldn't understand what was going on. And I began to dig in a little bit more in therapy after I started taking some medication that helped me kind of calm my nerves and, take me out of the immediate kind of crisis moment. And I began to realize that I had a lot of work to do. At that point in my life, I had sort of fallen into my father's footsteps of sex addiction and was acting out in all sorts of ways, trying still to sort of salve the wound and the hurt that had happened from when I was a child. And I was using the only tools that I had, and those tools were beginning to fail me and my body. And the brilliant thing about our bodies and the miracle of our bodies, there's an amazing book called The Body Keeps the Score. And so the things that happen to us in our past, whether we have wrestled them to the ground or understood them or re-narrated them or understood our past and our stories, whether we've logically done that, they are dictating so much of our lives. And it was the panic attacks. I was realizing that it was my body's sort of cry for help, saying, you need to look at this. There's something here is not right. Please pay attention before you lose yourself in, you know, the same way that your dad did. And it was in that moment, in that sort of kind of crisis point of my life, that I realized I need to do something about this. At that same time, someone had turned me on to an author by the name of Dan Allender. Dan wrote a book called The Wounded Heart, and The Wounded Heart is basically the Bible for adult victims of childhood sexual abuse. And so I started reading that and started to, oh, yeah, this is actually my story. Oh, of course, this is why I'm drawn to this sort of acting out. Of course, this is where I'm headed in terms of my addiction. And I realized at that same time that Dan had started a school in Seattle. It's now called the Seattle School for Theology and Psychology. And so in a twist not dissimilar to the one that the hero in our cave story took, where all of a sudden, oh, aha, I'd seen the light. I realized, yes, I now know what truth is. This is what's been going on all along. I decided in many ways, metaphorically, to re-enter the cave of my past to go to this school. For I don't even know what reason, except that I was compelled, I was pushed, I was pulled. Later, you know, I've come to realize, oh, of course, that's the Holy Spirit trying to, you know, push me and pull me into health and wholeness. But what that required was to call my agent and say, hey, I'm going to take 2 years off and I'm going to what I think is a seminary. And like you said, at that time, my career was kind of going up and to the right. I was going back and forth from Chicago to New York, being flown there to audition for Broadway shows. And everything just seemed like things were about to take off. But I think I had a really an opportunity that a lot of people don't get to sort of see. I have two paths. One is leading to life and one isn't. And I think I have to take this sort of lesser traveled path. And so there I was. I found myself in Seattle, taking 2 years off from acting, having no idea what on earth I was doing at seminary. I didn't want to be a pastor, which was the school of theology. I didn't want to be a therapist, which was the school of psychology. And I just knew I needed to be there. It was a sabbatical. It was, you know, 2 years of recovery. But while I was there, I heard another story. And this leads me to your original question of the two halves of my book. It's a story of the woman of Hagar, who's an Egyptian slave. And in the middle of the night, she runs away from her captors. And she's met at the riverbed by the angel of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord, after the ground shakes, asks her these questions and says, Hagar, where have you come from? Where are you going? And I realized that, oh, those were the two questions I was meant to answer during my 2 years in Seattle. And like I said before, I began to realize, you know, something that most of us don't until a crisis hits. So much of our past is dictating our present moment that we have no idea about. And so there I began doing the story work of uncovering these moments of trauma in my past, the generational trauma that had followed me from, you know, my entire family, and began to, as I unraveled those stories, experience some healing.
That is absolutely beautiful. And what we always want to hear, I mean, not every story has a happy ending, but every story can have a healthy ending. And you can choose that journey towards health and towards restoration. And that doesn't mean that your life is perfect now or that you don't have any problems or that you all of those struggles are completely gone. It just means that you have found hope and healing. And Blaine, just recently, actually on my Instagram, I had posted this quote from a previous podcast that I did with Jen Jones, and it says, your physical body can only plow through your emotional being for so long before it sounds an alarm. Mm. And as we experience that psychological trauma, it does present itself in physical ways. And I think it seems like God used that physical weakness, those physical symptoms, the debilitation of the panic attacks you had to get your attention, to move you in a completely different direction. I mean, we're going from SAG to seminary. That is definitely an unlikely journey. But,
oh,
you know, I think
that should have been a chapter title. That's the perfect alliteration, Jessica. But yes, you're right. Our bodies are always telling us something. And I think in, you know, the Western world, we're sort of designed to do everything we can to numb, to medicate, to ignore, focus on, you know, anything other than the pain, the feelings, I'm not feeling quite well. I began to, because I didn't have a choice, I had to listen to those signals. And I think that, that's maybe an encouragement to those listening, to just get curious when you feel those things, that knee that aches, but it's not from the football injury or the panic that ensues when you kind of go through a certain neighborhood or encounter a person in your life. That is your body and your spiritual being trying to alert you to a place that might need some care.
Well, I do believe that one of the best gifts that we can give our children as parents is to heal our own trauma and heal our hurts, our past hurts, so they don't become our children's burden to carry. And unless you take those intentional steps towards that journey like you did, you know, it wasn't like you just said, oh, okay, I want to give up this hurt. You had to unlearn and relearn things. And I know you went from SAG to seminary to a church. That wasn't perfect either. But Blaine, I know throughout all of that, your wife and your girls, your three daughters, have played a really big role in your healing journey. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah. So, you know, fortunately/unfortunately, my now wife, Margaret, we just celebrated 15 years. She was along for the ride for a lot of my unhealthy seasons. And, you know, some of that is we've kind of come to learn that both of us fell in love with the codependent parts of each other. At least that's what gravitated. That was the gravitational pull between us. I think that happens a lot in stories and in marriages and relationships, that what's really kind of pulling us together are some of the unhealthy, unhealed parts of our own past. Part of my work in Seattle was a relational mending, and both of Margaret and I doing our own separate work, especially during that season when I was away, realizing both of us needed to look at our past, look at where we had come from so that we could understand, you know, how that past was pushing us into a future and how that future was, you know, causing us to live in unhealthy ways in the present. Where we may have been attracted to some of the unhealthy parts, what I think we're realizing now later in our marriage is that we're also designed to heal each other's parts. Of course, there is work that you do by yourself, but there is a power in doing that work in community and in relationship, especially with a partner. And so, you know, I would say, you know, you said it before, that we are not healed, we are not finished. There are still things that are tricky in our marriage because of our different paths. But we're also realizing, oh, there's an enormous amount of redemption because of our past, because of those stories kind of coming together. And a good part of that redemption is, oh my God, we have three girls. I talk a lot about how I spent a lot of my life hiding. And hiding from everybody. It's really hard to hide from your spouse or your partner, but it's really hard to hide from your children. And I only can mm-hmm. say this because I only have girls, but I think it's impossible to hide from daughters. They just sniff it all out. They're just looking and they just know. And they're attuned in a way that I'm like, this is unfair, truly, to be honest. This is not fair. I've got all these women in my life now, but it is as hard as it is, it's an incredible gift to be the dad of now three daughters, and the redemption of that, especially given my story, especially given the dark places that some of my addiction had taken me, is just an absolute gift.
Well, Blaine, we only have about 3 minutes left, but I do want you to tell our listeners the story of your tattoo and your daughters.
So I, like, as I said, I, as an actor, I always thought, no, there's no way I can get a tattoo. I can't mark this blank canvas. I'm an artist, and so I need to be able to inhabit my whatever role. And so, of course, I cannot mark this canvas for the sake of whatever role that I am going to play in the future. And then something changed when we had our third daughter, and I started to realize how maybe I needed to live into the role I was currently inhabiting, which was a capital D dad and capital H husband. And so I came up with this idea that I'm going to have four perfectly drawn little tiny lines on my forearm, one to kind of represent each of the women that are most important to me in my life. And so a friend had come into town, and we went to this really reputable tattoo parlor. And as we were walking up, I saw a guy out front, and he just looked off. I was like, oh, where the place we were living, marijuana was legal. And it seemed like maybe, you know, he was enjoying a little bit of that. So I walk in, and as we're walking in, I tell my best friend, I hope that's not my guy. A few minutes later, after, you know, I drew what I wanted, I paid the fee, sat in the chair, and guess who walks in? But the guy,
that guy.
In, that we saw, that guy. But I thought, okay, I'm here. I've got the, you know, they put a little transparent thing on your arm. He's just tracing four lines. How could this go wrong?
Okay, hold that thought, Blaine. Hold that thought. How can that go wrong? I'm going to hold you over till the next segment, and we'll tell the end of the story.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
All right, so we're talking with Blaine Hogan, and we are right in the middle of his tattoo story where the sketchy guy comes in to do the tattoo. Blaine, what happened next?
Right. So I, again, thinking, how could someone get four straight lines wrong? There's just no possible way. Well, of course, that later that night, as I'm eating dinner with my best friend, just staring down at my tattoo, I'm like, this doesn't seem, is this straight to you? This doesn't seem, and I'm pulling and I'm trying to get it. And the next morning I wake up, and sure enough, these perfectly straight lines are not straight. They're kind of a little bit squiggly, one's fatter than the other. They're not evenly spaced. And so I go to show my daughters, and immediately I'm saying, I'm so sorry, you guys. I'm going to get this fixed. I'm going to even them out. They will all be straight. We'll fix this. Or I'm already starting to look up tattoo removal services. The day after, I have gotten my first tattoo. At the age of 42 years old. And as I tell them I'm going to get it erased or I'm going to get it fixed, they all start screaming, no, Dad, you cannot do that. And I'm like, what do you mean? I can't do that. It was meant to be four. I planned this out. And they start screaming, no. And I'm digging a little bit deeper. I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean I can't? And they're like, Dad, we're not perfect. We're not all the same. We're squiggly and we're different and we're bumpy and we're curvy. And so if you go and change those lines, you will have basically said, we're not your daughter. And I was like, you're right. You're absolutely right. The tattoo has stayed exactly as it is. There are times I look down at it and I go, oh, I wish it was perfect. But what it reminds me of is my life. it reminds me that I am not perfect, but I have made progress. That each of these lines is a testament to the progress that I have made in my life. It's a testament to the fact that I'm alive. It's a testament to the redemption and the grace that I've been given, because it not only resembles my life, but it reflects the life around me, that for some crazy reason, I've been given second and third and bajillion chances at doing this again and again and again. And, you know, like we say in our own family, practice doesn't make perfect. It makes progress. And so I look at these lines every single day, and not only am I reminded that my children are geniuses, but also what they're saying is absolutely true, that I'm not perfect, they're not perfect. That's not the goal. The goal is progress. The goal is just trying to do a little bit better every single day. And, you know, every day I wake up and can't believe I get a chance to try again.
Well, I love that. And you're right. Being healthy is not perfect. Healing is not perfect. We still have scars, but those scars remind us of where we've been, and they give us hope for where we're going. Blaine, before I let you go, I'll tell you this story about the genius of my children. One day I was sitting in the carpool line with my youngest, and I was trying to entertain him. I was trying to do this Bible study for church, and we were actually studying Revelation. He was bored, and so I started reading out loud, trying to distract him, and I was reading him the passage about Jesus coming out of the clouds, and you know, he's on a white horse, and King of Kings and Lord of Lords is written on his thigh. And my son, eyes, he was probably about 4 years old, they got so big in wonder. And I'm having this beautiful moment thinking, oh, listen to him listening to this. And he looks at me and he says, yes. Are you telling me that Jesus has a tattoo? Because it yes. said King of Kings and Lord of Lords is written on his thigh. So we're going to leave it at that. That's the theological question of the day. That'll leave it. Well, Blaine, where can our listeners connect with you, get your book, and learn more?
Sure. You can go to BlaineHogan.com or my Instagram, which is at Blaine Hogan as well.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the Dr. Nurse Mama radio show, Blaine. We're so grateful for your time and grateful for the hope that you've shared through your own healing journey.
Thanks, Jessica.
Well, we are talking this week about generational trauma. And, you know, the truth is we all carry something. Some of us carry something really small. Some of us carry something really big. But for me as a nurse, one of the really interesting things I learned was in doing my own family tree and looking at generational patterns, I did see addiction ran like a strangling vine through my family tree. And what I learned at that point when I was going to school was right around the same time that the human genome was being mapped. And we started to learn that when you don't have a healthy response to trauma, it literally changes the way that your DNA is read and transcribed. Now, in 1997, I was already out of high school, but we'll just leave it at that, researchers Vincent Felitti and Robert Anda from Kaiser Permanente Health, they published this landmark study on adverse childhood experiences. Now, we call these ACEs, and that connects childhood trauma to adult health outcomes. Now, hang with me for a minute here because this is really shocking. Now, ACEs, those adverse childhood experiences, they include things like abuse, neglect, mental illness, incarcerated relatives, if you've experienced divorce or seen violence in your family, life-threatening injuries, accidents, being separated from a parent or loved one, natural disasters, wars, terrorist attacks, extreme poverty. And, you know, reading through that list, there's probably not many people that haven't experienced one or more of those. And when we experience those things, those kinds of stress, it activates our stress response system. So I want you to imagine you're in the woods and you see a bear. When you see that, well, unless you're like my husband has a three-step process. I should digress here. I don't recommend this, but he has a three-step process when you see a bear. It's find the bear, make friends with the bear and ride the bear. But most of us are not like that. When you see a bear, your body goes into fight or flight mode. You get ready to fight that bear or run away from that bear. Now, what happens with ACEs is that you bring that bear home with you. And it can pop out of the closet, it can pop out from under your bed, and it activates that stress response over and over and over again and bathes your brain in a chemical stress bath. Now, some of these stressors we can control, some of them we absolutely cannot. We cannot control if a loved one dies or if there is a divorce that is not our choice. Our kids are going to encounter stress, but stress can be positive in small amounts. Tolerable stress is facing those serious events when they're buffered by supportive relationships. Now, hang with me, parents, because here is the hope. When we buffer that stress response by coming alongside our kids and not fix the situation, not cure the situation, not make it go away, we simply put our arm around them. We sit with them while they're crying. We tell them, I love you. Yes, this is tough. Things are going to get better. That literally changes their physical response to stress. So when they're stressed and they have surging epinephrine and cortisol and other dysregulated hormones, and it even disrupts their organs and damages their blood vessels and neurological regulation, us just being there in that moment buffers that stress response. It turns off that faucet in our brain. And it prevents biochemical changes that happen to our organs, to our blood vessels, and to our DNA. Now, that ACE study I told you about from 1997, it discovered something interesting. It discovered that adults who had a score of 4 or more ACEs, you can actually go online and find an ACE quiz yourself and take it and see what your score would be. 4 or more had a greater risk of physical health outcomes, just like Blaine was talking about, he experienced. So a score of over 4 had a 17 times greater risk of suicide, 9 times greater risk of substance abuse, 5 times greater risk of alcohol abuse, 3 times greater risk of depression, 2 times greater risk of heart disease. In fact, 9 of the 10 leading causes of death are actually correlated to high ACE scores. So what we take from that is that childhood trauma and stress put us at risk for physical illness as adults and even early death. The stress and trauma causes DNA changes that we pass to future generations. Now, that can make you afraid, but here's what I want you to know. Here's what I want you to know you will hear on this show. We do not succumb to fear-based parenting. We don't. We are faith informed. We can be informed about the issues that face us today, and we can use our faith as a tremendous resource to face them head on and to know that there are ways that God has provided for us in His Word through simple practices like praying for our kids, like reading our Bibles with our kids, and just being loving and supporting to them. So while we know that toxic stress changes our DNA, it changes our physical response that we pass on to generations, the opposite is true. And that is the hope there, that we can pass on healthy ways of changing and healing that we have had. And do you know what is the best protective factor to avoid a toxic stress response where our brain is sitting in that stressful chemical bath? That is the presence of a supportive adult in a child's life. So many times, parents, as parents, we put pressure on ourselves that we feel like we have to fix these things that our kids are facing. We have to be helicopter parents, and we have to hover around all the time to make sure that we're there should anything happen. We are lawnmower parents where we're making sure their world is manicured and perfect. We are bulldozer parents where we're knocking down any obstacle that they have, and we're trying so hard to be perfect. We are trying to be perfect parents, but here's the thing. Your kids don't need or want a perfect parent. They need a present parent. They need a parent who is going to be with them to navigate whatever life throws their way, who is going to be confident in saying, today is tough, tomorrow will be better. We have hope. We have restoration. We have redemption. There will be better times ahead. And there are some problems we will face that will not be fixed this side of heaven. But one day, those things will be made whole. And I've learned that in my own healing journey, to accept my own limitations. I know there's certain things that are still going to trigger me. There's still certain insecurities I have that are difficult, but I know those things about myself. And I have grace and space for healing. And I'm open with my kids about them. They know what those things are that bother me. And they are equipped to give me grace and space in those things and to know that certain holidays are harder for me than others. They don't resent me for it. They don't feel bitter about it. They feel equipped to help. Here's how we can make this day easier. And then I do the same back for them. Your investment in your family today is going to pay off in your grandchildren tomorrow and generations to come. But here's the thing, you have to be willing to take the journey. This is not something that happens overnight. This is a long journey, but it pays dividends. So I want to, as we're ending, I want to give you your conversation keys to help you start to unlock the door of your family and just start intentional conversation about what you're feeling. These are my conversation keys that I use in any number of situations. There's just four of them. How are you feeling about what's going on with us now? How are you feeling about the divorce we're experiencing, the move, the financial problems we're having? You think your kids don't know? They know. They look, they see, and initiating that conversation in a developmentally appropriate way is so important. How are you feeling about what happened? How is this impacting you personally? How can I support you and help you feel safer and healthier? And what do you think you can do to be a positive influence? Kids need to be motivated and empowered, even if it's something as simple as writing an encouraging letter or baking cookies or leading a family game, something that they can do that they feel like they're contributing. Well, that's it for today. Friends, thanks so much for tuning into the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, serving as your expert guide on the side to engage, equip, encourage, and empower families to navigate life's toughest issues. Tune in daily here on American Family Radio for conversation keys to strengthen your relationships and grow your faith. Connect with us online at drnursemama.com or on Facebook and Instagram at Dr. Nurse Mama. I'll see you next time.